The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why did you hang around in bars when you were a kid?
Well, I was accompanying my father as he hired hay hands in the hiring halls of the time, which were the 9 bars of White Sulphur Springs, Montana. And he was raising me by himself. He was a widower, as is Tom Harry here in The Bartender's Tale. And so those memories of the guys in the bars buying me Orange Crush Pop and giving me, I suppose, a nickel in those days, Cherie, to play the jukebox, that stuck with me and became sort of the fever of imagination, I suppose, behind this book of Rusty, who was 12 years old here in the book, and his father, the bartender Tom Harry.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Ivan Doig, who's the author of 11 novels and 4 books of nonfiction. During this program, we'll be talking about his new novel, The Bartender's Tale. Tom Harry is not a new character in your 11 novels. He's been in other novels. One I remember is Bucking the Sun. So why did you choose to bring him into this book as a main character?
Tom Harry has shown up, I think, in at least 3 of my previous books, with the largest role there in Bucking the Sun, when I put him amidst all the carousing of the 10,000 dam workers at Fort Peck in the 1930s, where he's running the famous and infamous Blue Eagle Saloon. As it turns out in this book, I'm not sure I mentioned that in Bucking the Sun, but his first act as a proprietor was to take the front door off the Blue Eagle so that it never closed day or night. He is a character that I kept writing in these books. He's in the background. He never had a leading role until now. But in thinking toward this book, thinking what I wanted to write next, the great what-if question that novelists are always doing, I thought, well, what if I gave him a kid to raise by himself? Because he's an avowed bachelor. He kind of scoffs at matrimony, as he calls matrimony, in one of the books. And I thought, well, what if I give him a more or less accidental son to raise by himself there in the joint and see what happens?
And that son, as you mentioned, is Rusty. And he is 12 years old. Most of the story takes place in the summer of 1960. And just describe this saloon, the Medicine Lodge. It's a normal bar in the front, but in the back is kind of a very interesting room.
The Medicine Lodge goes way back in my books, chronologically and in real time, to 1889, Dancing at the Rascal Fair, when Angus MacCaskill and Rob Barkley find their way to Gros Vin, Montana from Scotland. And there, Rob's uncle is presiding over the Medicine Lodge Saloon. And so it has shown up in various of my books. And it has grown over time, I guess, in my imagination. Even back there in 1889, Lucas Barkley, the original proprietor, bartender, and every other piece of the staff, was taking in saddles and so forth when guys didn't have money to, say, drink on or, you know, buy new clothes or whatever. And across 75 years or so, this stuff adds up in the back room, which apparently, as I put it down at least, might have been a part of an old stable there at the back of the joint. And now it is filling up with hocked stuff. The back of the saloon is sort of a pawn shop, I suppose you'd say. And so here are saddles, bridles, rodeo belt buckles by now in 1960. Sheep herders, yellow slicker coats, which, you know, used to stand out on the hills around here in Montana, along with the sheep wagons. And Rusty finds all this just a wonderful costume trunk, in essence. And so part of the plot is how all this stuff back there plays into Rusty's imagination. And it also is something of a concern to him as to what his father is doing with some of this stuff, as he disappears every so often with a car load of it. And so the back room plays the role sort of, I think in the Hitchcock movies, there's the MacGuffin, where something shows up and you're not quite clear what to make of it. And so Rusty and some of the other characters have to get clear on what does this back room really hold for all of us.
And for Rusty, when he goes in, and later on for his friend Zoe, who appears in that summer, there's also something else in the back room, something that's just their secret.
There is, and Rusty, I think propitiously for us, describes it as sort of a fabulous radio. He can look into and see the scenes happening. And so it's a vent into the bar room. He can sit up there at his dad's desk. There's a little landing going up to what would have been haymow, I guess, originally in the back room. And so there's the vent into the bar room. The customers down there can't see it. It's up amid the stuffed animal heads, which are always a mark of a Tom Harry bar. There's the one-eyed buffalo and all the other menagerie around the top of the bar room. And so Rusty and Zoe ultimately can eavesdrop and peek and so forth. And so this, too, feeds their imagination and helps them get a grip on adults. You know, what's going on down there, who's doing what. And so it became really a rich feed of my imagination as I wrote about these 12-year-olds up there observing the world.
Observing the world in a bar.
Yeah, yeah.
But a small
community center here.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say it's not just a bar. It's a place where things happen,
yeah,
and people find out about each other. And
yeah.
But it's a secret for Rusty and Zoe up there, because nobody else knows that they can see them or hear them.
That's right. What could be better for a kid?
Yeah. Especially when you're 12.
Yeah.
Well, let's just have you read the first part of the book so we can get a little bit more information about what's happening here in 1960.
All right. So we'll begin at the beginning, the opening page. My father was the best bartender who ever lived. No one really questioned that in a town like Grovon, glad of any honor, or out in the lonely sheep camps and bunkhouses and other parched locations of the Two Medicine Country, where the Medicine Lodge Saloon was viewed as a nearly holy oasis. What else was as reliable in life as sauntering into the oldest enterprise for 100 miles around and being met with just the right drink, whisking along the polished wood of the prodigious bar, along with a greeting as dependable as the time of day? Not even heaven promised such service. Growing up in back of the joint, as my father always called it, I could practically hear in my sleep the toasts that celebrated the Medicine Lodge as an unbeatable place, and Tom Harry as perfection of a certain kind behind the bar. Which was not to say, even the adherents comfortably straddling their bar stools might have admitted, that he added up to the best human being there ever was, or the absolute best father of all time, in ways I could list. Yet, as peculiar a pair as we made, the bachelor saloon keeper, with a streak of frost in his black pompadour, and the inquisitive boy, who had been an accident between the sheets, in the end, I would not have traded my involuntary parent for a more standard model. It is said it takes a good storyteller to turn ears into eyes. But luckily, life itself sometimes performs that trick on us. In what became our story together, when life took me by the ears, what a fortunate gamble it was that my father included me in his calling. Otherwise, I'd have missed out on the best seat in the house, the joint, rather, when history came hunting for him. I turned 12 that year of everything, 1960. But as my father would have said, it took some real getting there first.
And the line, when history came hunting for him, came in the form of a man named Delano Robertson, mm-hmm. who came to town in a cloud of sheep, as you write.
Yes.
I love that line. So explain that cloud and tell us why he's come to town.
All right. We're going to tease you would-be readers along a little bit with giving away a bit of the plot. 1960, Delano Robertson, fresh from the Library of Congress, a newly fledged oral historian.
With a grant,
which he has somehow eased away from the grasp of Alan Lomax, the great folk music collector and so forth there at the Library of Congress. And so Delano shows up with a Missing Voices project. And so he has his VW van full of tape recorders, tapes. It's the big reel tapes at those times, Cherie. Mm-hmm. He's living in the van as well. And he is determined to pick up the reminiscences, all kinds of interviews from the Fort Peck dam workers who did not have their story ever told, and really whatever else he can pick up. And so Delano shows up, and he is convinced that Tom Harry, the man behind the bar, who has heard all these stories at the Blue Eagle at Fort Peck, as well as the Medicine Lodge in Gros Vin, Tom Harry is his key to getting these people to tell their stories.
So he comes to try to convince him to go with him.
Exactly.
And we won't say whether he does or not.
There you go.
But the cloud of sheep happens when he's coming into town in that VW bus. Somebody's moving their sheep right through the town.
Right. And this is a very familiar scene to me, having witnessed it and having done it. DePuyer, where I lived during high school, I was on Highway 89. And part of our family life was moving the sheep from about 10 miles south of DePuyer to about 30-some miles north to the high ridge just north of the Two Medicine River. So that's about 4 days of trailing sheep along that highway. And DePuyer sits right on the highway there, and so we would push a couple of thousand sheep and a couple of thousand lambs right down Main Street, which is also Highway 89, and leave behind all the evidence that sheep leave behind.
I've seen that on highways, you know, driving out maybe someplace near Jordan,
yeah.
Montana, and you come over a hill and all of a sudden there are just sheep everywhere.
Yes, that was a very common thing back then. I'm speaking now of the mid-1950s on into the early 60s when my folks left that part of Montana, and I was away in college at that point. And when I came back, 15 or more years later, when Carol and I were researching this House of Sky, things had already changed a lot. The sheep empire, as that part of the country, part of Montana really was no longer.
When Rusty's 12 years old in the summer of 1960, a lot of things happen, including that Zoe is the new girl in town. Her parents have purchased the cafe where Rusty and his dad eat every night. And Rusty gets to go and choose whatever he wants to eat. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I ever saw him eat in the book for dinner was a cheeseburger and a milkshake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. This, too, comes somewhat out of my background. When my dad was raising me by himself there for those 3 or 4 years in White Sulphur Springs, he had some kind of an account at the Rainbow Cafe, which had the Rainbow Bar right next to it. And so I would go in there, and I think my usual order was a strawberry milkshake and a grilled cheese sandwich, probably. And so I put my imagination wildly to work and gave Rusty a slightly different menu.
And Rusty and Zoe that summer also got to go hear Shakespeare in the Parks.
They did. You're going to bring me back to Shakespeare here, aren't you?
I am, because,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
in a small town that doesn't have a lot of plays and theater and all of those kinds of things going on, Shakespeare in the Parks comes to town. It's a pretty big deal.
It is a big deal, and it's a life changer for these two. I'll give away that much. They are just dazzled by the costumes. And they tune in on a stage effect that I have wondered about sometimes. They just see these college students, by and large. You know, so some of them have their mustaches just kind of drawn on and whatever. And that lends a kind of authenticity, I guess, to the acting part of it, Sherry, as I imagine it with them. They saw that and thought, wow, you know, they can do that. Maybe we could do that. And so that with the wonderful costuming. And they cotton in on the flow of Shakespeare's language. Shakespeare shows up quite a bit in my books. One way or another, people are quoting him or referring to him. And I've just finished a sequel to Work Song, which is set in Butte in 19 and 20. And so Maury Morgan, the protagonist of that, is back a year or so later. And indeed, the title of that one is going to come, I hope, from Shakespeare. So, yeah.
Always good to throw Shakespeare
in there. Yes, right.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Ivan Doig about his novel, The Bartender's Tale. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. Don't go away.
People are always asking me, what's the book about? And they tend to mean plot and so forth. But I'm a little more literal in that. And so I always try to sum up to myself and to my editor and publisher in just a word or so what it's about, what the ultimate feel of the book is and what the story is. In The Whistling Season, which also had a 13-year-old protagonist in Paul Milliron. I think that was a book about compassion, about forgiving. And Work Song, by and large, seemed to me about redemption, as Maury and the Butte librarian I thought up, Sam Sanderson, They work out some of their past sins, I thought. And I thought the Bartender's Tale is about conscience. You know, what people do and don't do according to their sense of right and wrong. But, you know, I hope that that's simply tucked into the story. You don't want to blare it out loud. You know, as a novelist, you don't want the preaching to get in the way of the choir. You always have to be aware that the people are there to hear the singing, hear the story, and the language. The story of father and son left on their own in a shifting world, I guess, Sherry, is really what I was trying to get at in this book. Tom Harry is of the Depression generation, and setting it in 1960, the 60s are just over the horizon, and one of the characters is going to show up from over that horizon and blaze on into the 60s. But I'm interested in those kinds of hinges of history there in 1960. I push the historical framework a little bit, but in the book I have the missile silos coming into Montana at that point, the Minuteman missile silos, which indeed are going to play a role in the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. They are described as John Kennedy's ace in the hole, as the famous sign over one of them. I think it's the one on the way to Lewistown out of Great Falls there. And so a lot is changing in Montana then. The prairie, which first saw the buffalo, and then some cattle, and then sheep for a long time. It also sees now guys in the Air Force in these underground silos and so forth. The interstate highway system is coming in. There's really quite a lot of change in the air and on the ground. And I'm interested in how my characters respond to that.
So let's talk a little bit about your routine of writing. You know, people who aren't writers are always fascinated by how does this happen?
Well, you have to sit there every day.
You have to write. Oh, gosh.
And so that is often what people who think they want to write don't really want to hear. And you have to be your own best company. And that's something not everybody is cut out to be, too, that you have to spend time by yourself and probably not have a water cooler or whatever the modern equivalent is, to go visit with folks. So I've been a professional writer now for decades and decades. I sold my first small magazine article when I was a sophomore in college at Northwestern, and have written on and off, mostly on, ever since. And so I treat it like a job that I go to. And so I still rise very early, doing the chores on the ranch or something of that sort seems to have stuck with me. So I'm up early. I'm usually at work by six or so, and I write currently 400 words a day. That's two triple-spaced pages, and do some rewriting, do some research or whatever, and so it goes. If you write 400 words every day for 5 days a week, you've got a couple thousand words, and you do that for a couple of years, you have a manuscript.
Poof.
Yeah,
you have
a
book.
You're an overnight success. Exactly so.
Do you make an outline, or do these characters just develop as you go along, or do you kind of have them in your mind before you start writing?
One of the marks of being a professional writer, and now again for more than 30 years, a professional writer of books, is that I work on the basis of a proposal. I submit to the publisher, and the publisher, if they like it, and they always have so far, then issues a contract negotiated by my agent. And so the characters probably first show up in that. It may be only a page and a half of description of what the book may be. Delano Robertson's name got changed totally as it dawned on me as I worked on the book, for instance. So these things are very amendable. But I have in my head the arc of time that the book is going to happen within. And that accounts for a lot of what will happen in these characters' lives. And also the summer of 1960. Hey, it's an election year. It's John Kennedy versus Richard Nixon. Well, that gives you something to work with right there. And so there's that. I have, hundreds and hundreds of file cards of characteristics that go towards creating my characters. And sometimes it just features pop into my head. The skunk stripe that Tom Harry has in his black pompadour, I don't think that's been in previous books, but when I began writing him this time, I could see that that he had that graying streak down the middle of his black hair. And so the characters grow like that. Rusty meets Zoe in the top spot, and she immediately had to come to life in front of me and pretty much did there in on the page with a couple of days of tinkering. And so it grows like that. It's organic in a sense, but it's also the workings of my imagination and of my professional archive, in a sense, the file cards, the experience, Carol's photographs she's taken down through the years of the country and the people. And so it's like I always try to say when people talk to me, what's it like to be a writer? Well, you want to use the full orchestra, that you don't just want to be tinkling away in the timpani or something back there, that you want to pull in everything you know and everything you can lay your hands on.
Ivan Doig lives with his wife Carol in Seattle. You'll find lots more information about him and his books at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Also there, Monday poems, book reviews, and links to our podcast and Facebook page.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to author information, audio, and our Facebook and podcast feeds at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.